Sykes, 3. Cottie Shaw, being the commander of number 3 RNAS squadron, did this mean there was a considerable Canadian element?
Oh yes, that was so. Mm-hmm. Most of the pilots there were Canadians. There was a time when he, I think, tried to call it number 3 squadron RNAS Canadian, but that Canadian was crossed out and a few Englishmen were put in. Flight Commander Titch Rochford was one of them, and Flight Commander Elwood.
Who was your flight commander?
My flight commander was R.A. Little. He was an Australian, and he got a very big bag of victories to his credit. He believed in daily practice with a 2-2 rifle to keep his eye in, and he liked to shoot at moving targets. He got me to throw my naval cap up in the air like a clay pigeon, and he hit it with his rifle shot and put a bullet hole through it. I think most of his flight had bullet holes in their caps.
It was during your stay with this squadron that the Royal Air Force was formed. Did you feel that that the Royal Naval Air Service was superior or in its way to the Royal Flying Corps?
Well, there was great rivalry, and we all stood up for the Naval Air Service. We said that our machines were kept and maintained in better condition than the Flying Corps. I don't want to do them an injustice. Probably was that they were worked so hard they didn't have time to do maintenance sometimes. And the naval people did manage to get all the oil squeegeed off the machines, off the fabric.
As soon as you landed, did this happen?
As soon as we landed, our mechanic and rigger would come up with squeegees and get rid of the castor oil that had been thrown out from the rotary engine during the flight. And that left the machine looking trim and neat and tidy. If it was left on, the machines began to look a bit scruffy.
Number 3 squadron was involved in actions around Arras. What sort of actions did they carry out, and were you involved in them?
I was there on the airfield, and the airfield was being shelled, but I didn't know the ground, and I think I was sent out on the high offensive patrols, but not on the low flying. Most of the squadron was sent out to do low flying. The British Army would ask them to give infantry support to a certain village, but by the time they got there, the Germans had overrun the village, and it was in German hands, so it was difficult to help the British infantry. I think they must have had quite a lot of casualties doing that, because in my logbook I was sent on a number of trips to ferry machines back from the aircraft park to the squadron to replace ones that had been lost.
And on these high offensive patrols, did these often result in action, or was it fairly quiet on them?
I think it was very often action. We'd see parties of Germans and we'd fly towards them, or they'd fly towards us. There would be dogfights, and I've never had a very good idea of what happened during a dogfight. Machines circling round, a lot of machines in the sky, and the next minute you broke off to avoid colliding with somebody and did another circle, and you came back and the sky seemed to be empty, as if all the machines had vanished, died away, gone behind clouds.
When you were approaching another formation or an individual aircraft, how did you know it was which side it was on? By the markings or aircraft recognition?
Oh no, by aircraft recognition from the silhouette. We experienced people like the flight commander could recognize them and identify them probably 5 miles away, and they were just black specks in the sky. The beginners who just joined them, like myself, probably wouldn't even see the black specks. Have to wait until they got very close, although the leader usually waggled his wings and pointed as a sign that he'd spotted enemy aircraft.
Did the German aircraft waggle their wings too?
they seemed to get a little bit excited when they saw a British formation, and they banked and turned and did S-turns, and in doing so they showed us all their different silhouettes, the plan view and the elevation, and really identified themselves very completely by doing that.
What sort of appearance, for example, would a Fokker triplane have when you saw that?
Well, as it turned, it showed up a fairing that was on the axle between the wheels, and that seemed to look like a fourth plane, and very often at a certain angle of bank the Fokker triplane would look as if it had four planes, each one a bit longer than the other, to bring up to the top.
Were there any other sort of peculiar characteristics of aircraft?
There was the Fokker D7 biplane, and that had overhung aileron, as it was swept forward a bit at the tip, and when they banked you saw these horns sticking forward at the end of the upper wing, just sort of altered the silhouette of the plane a bit, and there was no doubt then it was a Fokker D7 biplane. I think the False and the Albatross that we saw looked somewhat similar from the front view, but if you could get an elevation of the tail, you could see a totally different tail. The tail fin and the rudder, the different shape.
Were there aircraft recognition courses, or like in the Second World War, did you just absorb this?
Never heard of an aircraft recognition course. They had models in the squadron of the different German machines, and they were stuck about at different angles, and we would go and look at them and study them to try and become familiar with them. There were other machines too. We had one of the Rumpler machines, we saw flying high occasionally. It had a particular fish-shaped tail to it, trailing from underneath.
When you were on a high altitude patrol and were well wrapped up, did you get very cold?
Our fingertips got very cold, and toes. Usually they were quite numb, the circulation had stopped. And we also were breathing, panting hard at the altitudes of 18,000 feet. Then when we came down, the circulation came back into our fingertips, and it got quite painful when we got down to the warmer, low air.
Were you very nervous returning to combat of, for example, say, Archie at all?
Yes, when I first went out on the patrols and we ran into a lot of Archie, I found it made me jump every time a shell went off. Nasty big bang and crack just close to me. It made me jump. These camels were so sensitive that when my hand jumped on the stick, it just jumped in the air a bit and back again. It looked rather bad when I was flying in formation with the others. I slowly got over this jumpiness and got back to normal like the others.
You mentioned a little earlier that your airfield had got shelled. What did you feel this was taking war a bit too seriously?
Yes, we did. We didn't like that at all. And the army was drawing back and going back all around. We had to wait orders to move. We had to wait something like 24 hours, and we were then told to fly away to another field farther north, behind Merville, on that front.
And then things quietened down a little bit for you?
Just for a day or so, and then the war started up there. The Germans made a big push against the Portuguese, who were holding that part of the line, and they pushed right through the Portuguese troops, and they were coming back, and they rushed a regiment of guards up there, and they held the Germans. I think that was the time when Sir Douglas Haig issued that famous order, with your backs to the wall, you mustn't retreat another foot. And I think that note was put up in our mess. We wondered how it applied to aircraft. And then we were shelled there again, and we moved back a few miles and finished up at Estrée Blanche, a little airfield just outside Estrée Blanche.
And then you, although the squadron was in action, you were still mainly involved in ferrying.
Then I went into action then with the squadron on its offensive patrols. The war in the trenches had quietened down a bit then, and there was a quiet period from then until beginning of August.
Did your flight commander take you on any particularly low-flying patrols at this time?
Yes, I remember my flight commander Little telling us that he was going to go over the lines, and he would come back and dive low onto the German trenches, and he would go down and touch his wheels on the parapet of the German trench, and he'd raise a little cloud of dust, and he wanted us to go down one after the other and do the same thing and follow him. Well, I was the last one. It was possibly all right for him, but I felt if I did that, then went straight across the no man's land, the Germans would just be standing up shooting at me. So when it came to my turn, I didn't bother to raise the cloud of dust or to touch the ground. I thought it was a bit hazardous, might have burst a tire. And I just zigzagged my way across no man's land, back over our trenches. Later on, I read in a book that our troops had seen the planes flying back and waving their wings to them as they flew over the British trench, but that wasn't quite the reason in my case. I was doing it to make a bad target for the German gunners.
Did Little often do this sort of thing, or was he sort of working off, just feeling a bit annoyed about something at the time?
Oh yes, I think he was, he said he was teaching me to be brave, but what had really happened was that a few days before that he'd been engaged in a fight high up, and his controls had been shot away, and his camel came down completely out of control, and on his way down he said he undid his safety belt, didn't know why, thought there might be a better chance to get out of the crash, but just before he reached the ground the machine suddenly righted itself from the spin with such force that it broke some part of the plane. The plane broke up and a wingtip hit the ground, and he, by sheer luck, was thrown into a very large and very soft manure heap. And he got back to the squadron the same evening, because I remember him coming in with his clothes smelling of manure, and I'd made some tactless remark about the smell. And I think it was the result of that remark of mine that made him take me out on this patrol where he was going to teach me to be brave.
Did you move to another squadron later on?
Yes, we had a quiet period during the summer, and then one day we heard a terrible bombardment going on to the south of us, 30 miles away in front of Amiens it would be, whereas things were still normal on orbit of the front by the Scarpe. Well, that night the telephone bell rang, and the wing said that four pilots had to be sent at once to the south, to 201 Squadron, as replacements. They'd lost a lot of pilots during the days fighting in front of Amiens. And so four new pilots who just joined us were mentioned, and then the wing rang back and said it'd be murder to send inexperienced pilots to the conditions that were existing then over the Somme, and they wanted four pilots with combat experience. And in the end, I think our commanding officer was away at the time, so gone somewhere on duty. But what happened in the end was they woke me up at 1 o'clock in the morning, and three friends of mine, Tom Seal from Vancouver Island, and Nick Carter, a Canadian, and Stone, he put us in the back of a lorry and said, you can continue sleeping on top of your kit, and you're going down to 201 as replacement pilots. And we got there and had some breakfast, and then they sent us out singly. They said we were not to have any fights, we would avoid them because it was dangerous. fights with single planes, better to wait until later in the day when we could be organized into pairs, with each of us with an experienced pilot who knew the area.
This single flight was just to pick up the local landmarks?
That's so, yes. It was more pick up the landmarks. But I see in my logbook entry against that first flight, I say that the 18-pounder guns were almost wheel-to-wheel, and they were all firing, and their shells were bursting along the trenches or where they'd been. So there was a lot of smoke about, and the trenches were quite easy to spot with so much activity, shell bursting shells going on all around them.